Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Michael, Mo, Tim, and the occasional guest discussing analytics issues of the day and periodically using explicit language while doing so. Find them on the web at analyticshour.io and on Twitter at analyticshour. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hey, Tim. You know, it's interesting. You and I actually were in the exact same city, but in different hotels when we recorded this episode of the podcast that we did with Nancy Duarte back in 2019.
And I think, we figured that out only like a week before we recorded. I was like, oh, you're going to be there? Oh, I'm going to be in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, it was right after I left Search Discovery and was just starting off on my own thing. And then you were going to be there and was like, oh, we were both going to be in the same town, but in different places. Anyway, sort of funny how the world works sometimes, but this episode is one that stands out, not because of our travel schedules, but because of the guest that we had, which was Nancy Duarte. And we were talking with her about her newest book at the time, Data Stories. It's funny, in the intro, we're like, this book's so new, like all your other books have won awards. And she goes, oh, actually, you know, we just did win an award. So like, it's like right as we did it. Like, so she's an award-winning author, and this book is no exception. Probably has won many other awards since. But the episode was super fun to listen to as well. Just somebody I've followed for so long and I looked up to.
Well, and that was, as we've gotten into some of these, where we're talking to people who we have known or followed from afar who have, you know, actually impacted a lot of people. I was realizing, listening back to it, that there were some specific nuggets, both from the book, but then she also talked about them, that as I've gone on to do like various, I mean, I've always done data visualization training here and there, but out of kind of the importance of it and necessity, I've kind of added, it's kind of morphed to sort of effective analytics communication, which then touches on data stories in some aspects, not nearly as adeptly and eloquently as and comprehensively as she does. But I realized that there are two or three things coming straight out of her thinking that I now actually directly speak to as well. But it's just fun talking to somebody who's so knowledgeable, so enthusiastic, yeah. So, you know, energetic and like clear and clean, because she's put so much thought and time into it. She was just absolutely delightful to talk to.
Yeah, definitely a mastery of the subject matter. Anyway, so actually, before we move on, it's probably worth mentioning, this is the last rebroadcast episode. We are, knock on wood, coming back live or with new episodes starting in 2 weeks. So this is our last rebroadcast episode. We're going to get the whole team back together, and I can't be more excited to re-kick off the show with everybody with some new episodes coming up here fairly shortly. But in the meantime, and in the form of a story, maybe even a data story, this is episode 130. You know, I'd like to tell you about someone named Sheila. She works at a very large company as a digital analyst. As you might imagine, she's responsible for a lot of data, reporting, insight generation, on a day-to-day basis. And Sheila's been increasingly frustrated in her job. See, she produces all this stuff, and despite her best efforts, the recommendations for how to advance the business are being ignored in meeting after meeting. Finally, in frustration, Sheila took the step of responding to a recruiter on LinkedIn and found a really great new job. Only a few months into the new job, Sheila is starting to see traces of the old in the new. With all of her experience in statistics and digital optimization, she can't seem to break through to the leaders in the company, so they'll act on what she is finding. All right, so Sheila's not real, but her story gets repeated again and again in digital analytics. Mo, did you connect with Sheila's story?
Well, I did, because with a name like Sheila, she must be from Australia.
Well, I actually looked up the connection between Sheila and Australia, because after I put the name, I was like, that's an Australian thing. I better make sure it's not bad or something.
Oh, we'll be talking about researching our stories later here, I can tell.
Oh, well, there you go. So what about you, Tim? Did you ever live this out?
I have. I sympathize. I connect with Sheila.
Yeah, and in my career, I have been a total Sheila, definitely.
I've said that about you many times.
Yeah.
Don't be a Sheila.
Oh, gee.
Okay. Well, so combining data and storytelling is extremely powerful. And that's what we wanted to talk about on this episode. So we turn to one of the best that there is in helping make that connection. Nancy Duarte is a communication expert who's been featured in Fortune, Time Magazine, Forbes, Fast Company, Wired, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Cosmopolitan, LA Times, and CNN. Her firm, Duarte Inc., is the global leader behind some of the most influential visual messages in business and culture. As a persuasion expert, she cracked the code for effectively incorporating story patterns into business communications. She's written 5 best-selling books, 4 of which have won awards. And today she is our guest. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, you guys. Hi, Sheila.
It's the 5th one's new, so has it just not really had a chance to win an award yet?
Well, it just did. I should have maybe said something.
Oh, wow.
Oh, now 5 for 5.
So on Friday, it won its award, its first one. It's one I had never even applied to. So my publisher, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So that one's won now.
Well, that's awesome and definitely deserved. And certainly we're going to cover that quite a bit. So to get us started, maybe, Nancy, you could just give our listeners a brief background on, you know, what you do and the work that your firm does.
Yeah. So my company, we've been around for 31 years and we have worked with the highest performing brands in the world. So for years, we actually would help you write, visualize, and deliver a great talk. So we have a service business that'll help you do that, or we will teach you how to do it for yourself. So we take all the learnings and the findings from actually working with, you know, real brands at scale. And then we kind of codified it into this training organization. So we do both. We'll either do it with and for you, or we'll teach you how to be a great communicator for yourselves.
And just for context, I first found out about Nancy from Leah Pika, who I saw present when she came to Sydney. And I remember talking to Leah about my desire and my goal to get over my fear of public speaking. And Slideology legitimately changed my life. It has sat on my desk ever since. I think every single time I write a presentation now, I go back and I look at it and I make sure I'm not committing any presentation sins.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's funny how many, because now I actually work at a design company and how many designers pick it up and they're like, oh, this is a great book. I'm like, yeah. But yeah, I'm so much more pumped about Data Story. It's like you heard and answered my prayers of what I wanted you to address next.
Yay.
So do you have people, I'm curious, your organization, because you have 120, 140 employees, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So is it really divided? Is there kind of one side that is the training side and one side that is the services side?
Yeah. So we have a team that actually will perform the services. And then there's these curators that kind of harvest some of the ideas, turn it into instructional design, programmatize it, and then we test it. We do an alpha, a beta, and then we launch it as a new product. For Data Story, I did the work myself and I dug through thousands of slides, thousands and thousands of slides to get to a couple thousand slides with just data on it. And so we use our own work as a research bed. So if you figure if we're working with the highest performing brands and they send us content, we look at it before they send it to us and even after they sent it to us to try to see how do they shape it? What did they try to say? What are they actually trying to communicate? Because you struggle, you know, and you create something that you think is great. And then they retain us to shape it more strongly. And so we use that as kind of our research bed for creating. Some training companies will go to Stanford and say, will you take my concept and prove it's true? You know, and you have to pay a lot of research dollars to do that. But we just go to what we feel like we know is true and find the findings in the bits of communication that we've shaped.
So with Data Story, your latest book, I suppose I'm curious to hear, what was the evolution from that? Was it clients coming to you and you saw that over time, data was becoming more entwined with what people were presenting and that was not being presented well?
Yeah. So what was happening is we kept getting feedback that they wanted us to produce a course that is a communication course for the way that analytical people communicate. So they would come to our course that say Resonate, which is a lot based on the discovery I made with that presentation form. And it's a bit more, they think, for a staged talk. And they would say things like, well, Nancy, I'm normal and I do normal presentations. And why don't you study normal people? And I was like, I don't want to study normal people. I want to study great people. But I didn't hear the question behind the question. What they were saying is, I make analytical presentations, make a course for me, you know, was a more. So what I did originally is I had a whole course built. It was a day and a half, but it was really about visualizing data. And yet I thought there's a lot of courses out there like that already, right? We've got Stephen Few. We've got even Tufte in a way. You've got a lot of books even written around visualizing data. So when I stepped back, I brought somebody in. I had all the models and visuals. So it was all pasted, like threw it up all over the wall. And this person came in and they were like, I don't see what's uniquely Duarte here. I don't see it at all. And man, that just spun me around and was like, oh my God, I need to go into our own work and find what is uniquely Duarte. And I remember I put it like literally this whole wall was just papered in little bitty bitty slides, little bitty, like I think I did 24 up slides on 11 by 17 paper. And that was like immediately I saw the annotation taxonomy. And I don't think a taxonomy for annotations over charts has ever been done like what's done in Data Story. So right away I could see what my team did after a chart was plotted, how they overlaid it, and how they drew attention to different things outside of the typical things like colorizing and highlighting, how they drew things on top of the charts to really create clarity. And so that was fun. And then I deconstructed all the words that were associated with the charts. I looked at the, what was the noun? What's the adjective? What's the adverb? What's, you know, what were all of the words? And then the big kind of aha was, what were the verbs associated with the data? Because that means that's the action someone was asking someone to take because of the data. And that to me was the most interesting part of that whole research project.
Yeah, the verbs piece left me spinning for a few days because I was actually working on some recommendations for our executive team. And I just kept going back to that list of verbs and my write-up and realizing how much, and I kept kind of tweaking it, trying different. So basically in Nancy's book, there's a list of different verbs depending on what you're trying to get your audience to do or what action you're trying to get them to take. And I just kept going back to the list and rereading the sentence using different verbs. And I just don't think I thought about what a difference it makes to your recommendation and how purposeful you have to be with your choice of words.
Yeah, I think that was the big thing was when once I wrote all the verbs, first I categorized them into four things. And then one of my content people's like, nope, it's two. It's only two things. It's process verbs and performance verbs. So you have performance verbs, which are primarily what executives care about. And that's what they're measured to. KPIs are performance verbs. And then process verbs, you could tuck a bunch of them underneath a performance verb. And that's how you get it done. It's kind of like when you run, you could say, oh, the verb is run. But to run, you have a lot of micro verbs like swing your arms, breathe in and out, pump your legs, right? Those are all process verbs you do in service of run. And so it's kind of like that. There's this performance verb that has a bunch of process verbs you could tuck under it, but you'll get the attention of an executive if you use a performance verb over a process verb. Yeah. Mm. That was so fun. I love pattern finding. It's so cool to go into this work and find these patterns. It's just a blast.
It was fascinating to me that I have long contended that the reason so many presentations are terrible is because we watch so many terrible ones. And even though they're boring and they're terrible and we can't remember what was said and they're not impactful, we're still learning from them. And then we go and repeat what was done poorly. And you really, with Data Stories, you flipped that on its head and said, let's not go work just in kind of theoretical world with what we think should work. You went in and kind of found stuff that worked and then did an analysis of that, which was actually, you looked through so much stuff and also a lot of it was influenced by what you had done. So you were actually going to find good stuff. I'm pretty sure there are organizations you could go to where you'd look through everything they'd ever done. And I have some of those companies as clients and they all make me cringe. but can we back up a little bit because, and I know I've watched Leah struggle with this. I've struggled with this when I'm working with analysts. I imagine you have to have run into people who say, I get all this theory. I get how much better things are that you and your team produce. I even get that if I internalize all of this information, I could produce better things. But either I don't have the time or I'm not really presenting to executives that often. And does that mean that I mean, I'm sure nobody would be so rude as to say it means this doesn't matter. But how do you find yourself having to kind of make the case for fundamentally why, and this is data stories and even broader, let's go Siteology and Resonate, kind of the whole premise. Because I feel like that case still needs to be made to analysts, and sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not.
Yeah. There was a really interesting study that Jeff Weiner talked about, CEO of LinkedIn, at his Talent Connect conference. And now that, you know, LinkedIn has the job openings and it has the resumes to fill them. And by far, bar none, number one gap is a soft skills gap, and that's a communication gap. Huge, like 1.63 million or something gaps in resumes, by far biggest. Of the number one in that category was communication, oral and written. Number one gap. That's what everyone's looking for. I've burnt through, like literally burnt through, two data analysts because they couldn't thrive in a communications firm, right? They could only like kick out, they just like do little projectiles of little bits of data, and it didn't really help anybody. And it is interesting to me how a lot of people think they don't need to communicate with the threat of artificial intelligence. Being an empathetic communicator is one of the few things a robot and AI will never be able to do. Now we're getting really close where AI can synthesize data. It can read data. It can make observations about data. It can point to a potential anomaly in the data, and it can say, I think quarter over quarter, Jimmy Bob is down. You might want to look at that. It won't say, this is what Jimmy Bob is doing that made his numbers go down. It won't say, here's how to have a conversation with Jimmy Bob to make his numbers go the right direction. It'll just make a claim about the data. Now, robots will be able to do that. So analysts, somewhat, a lot of their job would be teed up to a point for them, but having the conversations and deciding, I mean, we go into data. Nobody's challenged me. Maybe you guys are a better trio to do that, but I just really, really couldn't find any other reason to go into data unless it's to find a problem or identify an opportunity. Well, that's the analyst's job, is to go and see what's going on in the data. But at some point, it turns into a communication problem, because once you find the problem or the opportunity, it becomes a communication problem. If you don't want to sign up to be the communicator in that instance, then a robot may eventually be able to take your job. I don't know. AI. Communicating in general, I think it's a make or break career thing. I really do. It's a threshold some people choose to cross. I think the ones that choose not to cross it do tend to stay individual contributors, which is fine. It's wonderful to have individual contributors that are really strong in a craft. But I do think becoming a communicator differentiates you as a leader eventually.
But I think those people also wind up feeling like they're the ones who also are like, why am I just generating reports? Why am I not, why do I not have a seat at the table? So it is kind of a self-fulfilling. I do that LinkedIn stat because it was in the book, and I don't know that I've seen a job description in the last 15 years that doesn't say need strong written and oral communication skills. I feel like that's like filler. So I was curious. We don't need to go into that, how they actually, I don't know. It just feels like that always gets slapped in, and I don't know how you actually.
But okay, Tim, can I just interrupt you for a sec? This has been on my mind so much because I do a lot of interviewing for our team, and a really strong technical capability is absolutely important. But I had an interview a while back and I really struggled with the decision because the interviewee was exceptionally technical. We do an interview that goes through like their communication skills, their values. We do a technical interview and then sort of a dashboarding interview to get their idea of data visualization. And she could explain every single technical concept. I mean, she could get it. She could be like, I need to run this model. But when I tried to drill into like, okay, why that model? What's the question you're trying to answer? What's the business problem? Like, how would you communicate that to someone that doesn't understand what regression is? Or like, and that disconnect was there. And it really made me think a lot about, is it a trainable skill? Like, do you hire someone knowing that they're not good at that? And do you try and invest and train them? Or is it like, you've got it or you don't?
What is the answer to that one?
The whole, are you born with it or not? You know what I think not to get completely stereotypical here, but I do think introverts and extroverts are different types of communicators. An extrovert will just blather and shout things out and shoot from the hip, and it doesn't have as much content. It's not as thoughtfully crafted. It's not as thoughtfully thought through, because they just don't spend their time thoughtfully thinking sometimes. Whereas an introvert always, a lot of times, has the right answers. They just don't have the guts or the bravery to speak up and say it. So I tend to be kind of the front person in the company, but my husband's the more thoughtful, careful communicator, if you can get him to stand up at a staff meeting. That's the big if. He's just so beautiful. Like, his word choices are great. His concepts are great. His metaphors are even great, because he's a deep, thoughtful, contemplative person with a deep well of wisdom, but it's just getting him to speak. And so I do think that a lot of the data roles are more analytical people, and they do tend to not be as comfortable. So if we can get the analytic people to be more comfortable speaking up and framing things carefully, I think there's more wisdom that comes out of their mouths. And I'm wishing for more of that.
I wonder if there are introverts who watch the extroverts just kind of maybe sometimes be a little all over the place, but still be energetic, maybe not the best presentation. And then sometimes if that's all they have, I mean, I think that's where like the service, I'll fanboy out a little bit, like the books and the examples you've laid out, because they are so prescriptive. It's like, I just kind of want to beat people over the head and say, like, just find the time, read this, because if you actually try to apply it and you're not going to be perfect with it, and you may not feel natural presenting until you've done it for a while. But I like the idea of the introvert, who I would think is also maybe just more concerned about, just has more nerves about it, and therefore is more inclined to prepare and try to feel the importance of being able to say something, because they don't want to just find themselves kind of winging it.
Yeah. And I think that we need to give more oxygen in the room and not speak up so quickly. Like, my son is an introvert. Like, on the scale of introversion, he might be like hermit way over here. And I literally figured out that I have to count to 7, like 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3, like literally in my head. Because what he does is he frames and thinks through what he's going to say, so it's beautifully formed. And then it comes out of his mouth. But what happens is my daughter and I are like, bah, 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 bah. And then he'll just sit there, and he has really rich stuff, but he's not given enough time to shape it the way he wants it, so it can come out of his mouth carefully.
I feel like this work that people need to do to grow in this skill is also very deeply personal, because to have empathy, to start to kind of dig into these things as it pertains to personality and how I interact with others, how do you coach people to sort of grapple with that? Because it's almost like a phrase that's sort of been going through my head, and I've been testing a lot lately, is sort of to gain context on someone else or something else, we first have to look through ourselves. And so our own level of self-awareness will kind of dictate the level of the context that we can draw from or see in something else. So like, if I'm helping advise someone on what to do with their data and analytics, I'm kind of applying my own set of filters first, and then getting to theirs. And I'm more or less helpful depending on how that works. But I just wonder, like, I'm feeling some weird emotions actually talking about this. I don't know if anybody else is, but like, I feel
my lack of emotional intelligence means I'm not picking up on that. So,
but that's what I'm just wondering, like, do you ever have that happen where somebody has a weird emotional reaction to this kind of stuff?
To meaning like a visceral reaction because they're scared to present, or like a
maybe not the same, like fear of presenting or fear of like being up in front of people. It's pretty well understood, but like, the idea of grappling with these concepts and like, hey, I'm going to develop a set of skills that's going to make me a better and more empathetic communicator. Like, I think maybe I'm just really passionate about analytics, but like, I'm like all kinds of emotions right now.
He's all emotional about it.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm all emotional about it.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of work done bringing empathy to data, really. Like, oh, you know, data will just sit in its little cells unless someone, you know, pulls it out, decides a point of view, and then decides something needs to happen from it. And once we decide that the trajectory of the data needs to change, and humans can do it. So you think about how much data we collect. It's collected mostly by human or human activity or human behavior or Internet of Things, like just vast amounts of purchasing habits. Humans generate a lot of the data. So that means that if you want your data to be different in 18 months, humans are going to generate data a different way. You're wanting them to change their behavior. And that's going to take empathy. That's where empathy comes in, right? You say, oh, hi, employees, we need our revenue to be higher. Therefore, you need to behave like this to change this number. Mm-hmm. And communication will not be effective without empathy at its core. And every one of my books has empathy at its core. It's about making it clearer, making it more understandable, making it audience-centric, making it so the leader understands what change management looks like. Whichever of all the books, they all have something, a tool or a visual or a structure for empathy. And that is largely because I'd never had empathy modeled for me. So it's partly my own quest as I'm grown myself as a leader and find myself in situations where I'm struggling to see things from someone else's perspective, then I'm like, this must be a void. So even with data stories, so we have lots of data here, but I also kept getting feedback in our anonymous surveys, which are always the funnest ones, right? Yeah. Like Nancy doesn't make decisions. Executive team doesn't make decisions quickly. There's a whole bunch of stuff that need decisions and no one's making it. And I'm like, tell me, I'm super fast at decisions if you tee it up clearly. And that's where that section in the book is. But I'll be sitting serving coffee in the break room. And, you know, I think someone's just making small chatter. And they're actually asking for a decision for me. And I don't know. I'm thinking, oh, that's what an interesting day you're having. Like not thinking they're like, I'm thinking they're just like, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, good luck solving that, you know?
Right.
And so I don't know that there's been a book where an executive wrote a way that they need to be communicated to, because it just wasn't clear to me as the leader that they were asking for decisions to be made. And man, I could whip out decisions. I always have opinions. And so that was so bizarre to me that I would be accused of that. What was hard for me when the book was done was how few charts were actually in it. Outside of the annotation section, I think there's only like 7 charts. And of those charts, I think 2 have real data and the other 5 are made up, because it's really about making a point. How do you communicate it? Hmm. You know, if it's this, how do you communicate? If it's that, how do you communicate it? So it was weird. I mean, it wasn't until I actually got the digital file when it was going to print as a book. I was like, wow, that's how many charts are in it. There's not that many. Wow. Then I thought, oh God, I hope it's credible, because there's not a whole lot of charts about regression, you know, and all that stuff.
Yeah. No, but I love how much thought goes into your stakeholders. And actually, I don't think people do it enough, thinking about, you know, how does this person absorb information? How do they think about stuff? Like, what language do I use that's going to be effective for them versus your own personal preferences? The only question I do have on that is, because I was thinking so much about the section you talk about, like whether someone's visual or, you know, like how do they like to digest information? Is there a particular chart type or a particular way they like to see numbers? What do you do when you have a CEO that has one particular preference and then say like a COO who has a very different type of preference? And whenever you're getting a decision made, you're going to have multiple executives in the room and they're, you know, polar opposites. I was thinking a lot about that, because it's really hard to appease both audiences.
Yeah. We have a client where the guy who runs the whole thing, the chairman, will only ever accept data as tables, and it can only either be black or red. Like that's it. And it has to all be in table format. Whereas others are like, whoa, there's so much more sophisticated ways for us to communicate to our customers or communicate to others or to get decisions made. I think you have to know your audience, and it depends on who is who. So if there's someone who only wants tables in a printout, I'm telling you, if you're looking for a $100 million budget, or I don't know what you're in there asking for, but I give each of them whatever it is they want, you know, stand and deliver, and then have the freaking black and white with red charts, like whatever it is that each one needs of how they receive information. We do a lot of pre-reads here. So by the time humans are in the room, it's not a presentation. The documents are read and it's a conversation. Mm. And so we send out the read aheads. And then if they didn't read it, they get 10 minutes at the beginning of a meeting. Everyone just reads it, and you're saving the entire time for alignment, for decision making, for, you know, getting real work done, real business decisions done, so that it's, so it just expedites things to do it that way. And in that case, I would give it everyone the way they like information.
Guys, that kind of sounds like the old memo rearing its ugly head. They give me lots of shit because my last company used to use Jeff Bezos's memo, and we'd write like a one or a three pager, and everyone would read it before, all your analysis was in the appendix, and you would go to the meeting purely to make a decision. And I thought it was completely and utterly fab, but I'd get lots of shit for it.
Well, so I'm concerned, Mo, because you don't remember that actually I was a fan of that and only Tim was giving you crap about it.
Well, I generalize.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I want to call out a little bit, like, if we went to all of our listeners and said, how often are you stuck presenting to a CEO and a COO who have differing, and, you know, like that, that's a little bit of a straw man kind of construct. I feel like I certainly find myself presenting to the same stakeholders again and again. And there's a degree of just paying attention to what they gravitate to and what they don't when it comes to figuring out how to present to them.
Yeah, I agree. It is more common. And that's where getting to know them. In the book, I say find a sponsor, find somebody else who's communicated with them successfully, find out what they really like, find out the way they like to receive it. Not everyone likes a read ahead, but anyone who works for me knows I will read whatever you send me the night before our meeting, and I will come with it redlined with questions. It's how I prefer to do it, because I feel I get more done when the time is used around that. But not everyone's that way. Other people do like to be presented to. Like, we have a client, I'll do this really thoughtful slide doc, beautiful. It's got all the answers in it. I'm like, hey, read this and we'll meet. And every single time it's like, well, I have to hear your narrative. I have to hear the verbal narrative that goes with it. I was like, no, it was a document. Like, no, read it. It's like, so some cultures just don't read. Like, mm-hmm. They want you to have a visual aid and a verbal dialogue. And I'm starting to, now that I've sent two of these over and realize I don't think they're reading it, we're going to not put the effort in the document, and we're going to just make a couple slides and do a verbal narrative.
Maybe send them an audio file.
Yeah.
Maybe they're auditory.
I've recorded private little videos with voiceovers to get people to.
We do that all the time.
So I spent years railing against assignments. Gar Reynolds kind of coining that. And I think in Data Stories, you briefly kind of allude to assignment. Like, the concept behind, because I see a lot more assignments, and my fear would be people would hear, they hear slide docs, they get a quick overview. They may remember in the moment that slide docs does not mean just slap everything onto a slide and then present it.
Right.
I just, the large financial services and healthcare companies I've worked with, where literally 100% of what they present are slidements. Uh-huh. And they may say, this is what we're used to. There's this layer. So I guess, can you sort of define the difference between a slidement and a slide doc? And then maybe also in Data Stories, you talk about kind of the three ways of, you know, persuasive presentation versus a slide doc versus exhaustive, I'm reciting this from memory, exhaustive documentation.
Yeah.
Can you kind of draw the lines between those?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, when Slideology came out, people started to understand, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to be using cinematic. It's supposed to be a backdrop. It's supposed to be highly conceptual, because they can't read at the same time that I'm talking. You can't do a verbal and a visual stream at the same time. So the pressure to become really simple and clear on stage became a norm. And then what was happening is internally and other, I started to talk to all our customers, started to talk to everybody who interviewed me, what percent of presentations that you do are internal? And they're like, oh, 85%. Of those, how many of them are cinematic versus dense? And they're like, they're all dense. Well, why are they dense? Well, they have to be dense because the nature of what we're talking about, number one, it needs to float around the organization without a presenter and be understood. Right. So it had to be able to travel. And that I realized that slides were like, instead of everyone having to go to InDesign and hire a designer, they were actually using these for their visual documents or their visual memos, if that's what Mo wants to call them. Right? There was visual memos or visual documentation. So most of them were done that. So instead of vilifying that format with the slideument like Gar did, what he and I both agree is wrong is when you stand up and present with a verbal stream very dense slides. But if you want to make dense slides, in this we call them a slide doc. It could be a read ahead. It could be a leave behind. It could be something that floats all around the organization with the context of your narrative coupled with it. That's awesome. In fact, decisions get made. In fact, there's a whole new movement, obviously, that happens now with Google Slides and Google Docs. People don't even do meetings. They just co-create a draft. Everyone says a thumbs up. We all agree this is true. They move on. They don't even have to meet. They pile all their docs. They pile all their charts in there. They pile all their narrative in there, and everyone just reads it together, and then they have consensus. So much of what we do is in service of building consensus. So there's this, the denser slide doc, it's like a magazine layout. People don't realize that Keynote and PowerPoint, there is a way to build masters that can have a 6-column grid, just like a magazine. Beautiful. And you could put 6 8-point type in it. You could put all your type in it. They look like a magazine, beautifully done. We do entire sales enablement systems for companies as slide docs. Then the sales team can rearrange and make their own little brochures out of this beautiful deck of 100 or 200 slides. They can move things around and rearrange them. And they're stunning. They're client-facing, beautiful, and ready to go. Now, what Gar and I absolutely agree on is that this weird thing in the middle where it's not a document and it's not a cinematic visual aid, that's the devil's work, right? When it fits in between, where it's not so dense, it's not terrible, but it's dense enough that you're using your slides as a teleprompter. That's where it gets really in this bizarre place where the presenter doesn't do as well, the content isn't delivered as well. And so that's kind of that spectrum, the spectrum of how you can use presentation software. And we're trying to knock that middle part out and say, look, either go full on visual aid or just pass around a document, but don't do this weird thing in the middle.
So one, just to call out in case we forget. So slidedocs.com, which redirects to duarte.com/slidedocs, has all sorts of like super useful information. And I think that to me, that was with the care that the people who are a presentation that's created with, I'm just getting all my thoughts down and now they're in slides and I can present them. That tends to be the slidegement. Whereas what you go into a lot of detail talking about is if you're doing a slide doc, that's a slide doc. you're very polite about it. To me, I read it as that's not an excuse to just say, oh, it's a slide doc, so now
make it ugly.
Go nuts. Like you talk about the structure and approach and purpose for all of that as well. So,
all right. Well, the show is going great, but we need to step aside and talk about one of our sponsors here on the Multi-Touch Moment. Hey, Josh, you know how different organizations have different ways of selling, and there's all kinds of different ones, but finally there's an analytics platform structured to recognize that fact. If your company is a B2C company, then you can sign up for the B2 Analytics B2C package and get a predefined set of reports that are consumer-focused. Or are you more of a B2B operator? Well, then you just sign up for the B2B package, and those reports are all set up for B2B marketing.
Well, you know, Helbs, I think it's a little more complicated than that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what are you more of? Maybe you're a B2B2C company, and so you'd need to get a package for that, and B2 Analytics has you covered there as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. And on top of that, for Star Wars fans, there's the B2R2 package.
Maybe you're selling to everyone. Then it's a B2E package. It's really comprehensive, and it doesn't matter what kind of business you have. From B to Shining Sea, there is a B2 Analytics package right for you. Check them out. B2 Analytics. Let's get back to the show.
I want to turn things in a slightly different note. So for context, like I love the idea of a data story and I think really hard, even when I'm just sharing some analysis that I've done over email, I think about the titles of the paragraphs, I think about the points that are in there. And I suppose one of the things that I kind of struggle with is that you do all of this work, you have this amazing data story, you present it to your stakeholders, keeping all of the best practice in mind. And I've started using this phrase, which might be a little bit controversial, but it's called weaponizing data. So you present this amazing data story, which has been set out, like you've used all the best data viz practices, and then a stakeholder gets that. They understand it because you've thought really well how to explain it and display it. But then they pick the bits they like, and then it goes on to someone else in the business. And then suddenly you don't have control of that story anymore because it's now become part of their narrative. I suppose I'm wondering, like, how is there a way or a technique that you could use? I mean, it comes down to like data politics, I guess. I don't know. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
I don't know. I mean, you know what is interesting about that whole thing is clearly something that was done stuck enough that it took on a life afterwards, right? Like really great slides do that. We say they breed like bunnies, and you want that, right? You want your best thinking to be picked up and multiplied and multiplied. You want the strategy slide you made. You want the whole company. You want it to just rip and suddenly you see it in everyone's deck, right? That's how you make a way. What's too bad about data is the framing, right? The context, the assumptions, how careful you were to also, you know, make sure it was approached without bias, right? All the kind of thoughtful things you did, and it can take on a life of its own. I guess the good news is it took on a life of its own. The bad news is it's just like in life, you can't control the messaging ever. You just can't. Yeah.
Mm. I suppose though, particularly in that context, people will come back to you because eventually it's like, oh, Mo did that analysis. And then someone will loop back to you. I suppose my technique at the moment is to be like, actually, I think it's worthwhile reviewing the full analysis. Here is what I initially prepared, which has all my assumptions. Are you happy for me to share that with you?
Yeah.
But other than that, yeah, I suppose it's...
You keep sending them back to the origin. Or you can also put on the bottom of every slide or however you do it, or the graphics, you can say, put the directory of where the original file is, like attach it to every single thing, where it is on the server or what the name of the original. Mm. There's a preferences field in almost every software where it'll say authored by, and you can put your name authored by. That way, when they open the file, it'll say you were the author of the file. You know, there's just things like that. So you could just say, hey, if you have questions about the origins of this, to put your contact information all over the place, all that stuff. It doesn't hurt to do that.
Mm.
Especially if it's high stakes, man. I mean, some of the decisions made from data are glorious and terrifying all at the same time. And mm-hmm. So we just, you know, maybe need to treat it with more respect. Like, you're pretty passionate about that. It's cool.
I'm curious about the executive who wanted things, only wants things in tables.
I had an exec that only wanted line graphs ever. Did not want to see another graph. I just gave her line graphs.
But I can't remember if that was in the book or if it was on Leah, I remember that anecdote. And I go back to when I've had clients and they've said, well, this is the way we like to see it. And it's a sea of numbers. And I'm like, yeah, you're getting this every week. So this is more kind of on a reporting front where it's what they're used to. But just as human beings, just with iconic memory and the visual sensory register, like, they can't possibly take it in. Do you find yourself where people say, this is what I want? Or even when you your example of going around the organization and they said no, when you were discovering the need for slide docs, was there like 30% was bullshit when they said no, this is the way we have to do it? How much of it is inertia conditioned without thought versus if you can work in a better, more visual, more narrative, cleaner? I don't know. Like, did you just kind of accept it?
I guess I'm trying to think about, like, I do at, like, I'm a visual person, but like, I have a chart right here that's got like rows and columns, and one of them's highlighted, and then things are checked off. Like, my team knows that I can process certain things quicker. Now, I don't ask for everything this way, but I would rather serve up information the way a key stakeholder says they want it, then blow them off, right? Then try to transfer.
You're wrong.
To try to say, like, and it kills me, but I need paper. I know exactly. I have different little piles on my thing. I can go and recall a piece of paper faster than I can a digital one.
Hmm.
And so a lot of they know, come and it's printed and it's clipped, and I'm not high maintenance at all, but then I can go back and refer to it because I have things kind of chronological, and then I have literally the urgent things right here on the floor to my right. So it's like, I just know where everything is spatially. I'm spatial. Hmm. And I just think everybody is a different type of learner. Some can handle like sitting and reading narrative, but you know, if they have a driver, if an executive has a driver, they can spend time reading stuff. But like, the speed in which they go, if they don't have a handler, briefing them verbally all the time, it's hard to get through a ton of sitting down and thinking carefully. We have Domo, like I have other business intelligence tools, and it never failed, even though it could plot things. I still was like, wait, I got to see that number. I was constantly downloading it into Excel files myself and just being like, something seems off, right? And then I would try to figure out and solve it myself. So I don't know, I'm only speaking for myself, but man, we give our clients the data, the powerful ones, because we work with like the top execs. We give them their documents in the format they process information. I wouldn't mess with that at all.
Do you have clients, though, that have said organizationally, we're not doing a good job at communicating from soup to nuts, where you're kind of doing kind of a strategic communication overhaul?
Yeah. So we do strategic communication. So we'll do strategy, their whole comm strategy for a department or a brand. And then it could last 18 months. We'll do larger digital transformation strategies. We have a couple of the software companies here that are going to start to take away some of the entitlements that they get, all the free stuff they're giving. So that's going to be fun. We have to make communication strategies for that. Yeah. And then we'll take it systemic. That's what the book Illuminate was about. Because there I took storytelling and coupled it with movements. So we looked at the civil rights movement. We looked at the open software movement. We looked at the migration from macOS 9 to 10. That was a movement. So we looked at all these different movements over time and looked at the communication that was done to move people in mass over time. And so that's what we do for companies. So we'll do just their moment, or we'll help them drive their whole movement, of which these moments are moments in a larger movement, like an epic tale.
Speaking of movements, if you were tasked with, I feel like every business at the moment is on this journey at the moment where they're like, how do we make our business data literate? So basically, if you want to create a culture of data virality where everyone actually thinks about at least using some numbers to inform their decisions, I have my thoughts about how I would strategize that, but I'm interested to hear how you would go about it.
You know, what's interesting is, I mean, there's data literacy, people will call it, there's data visual literacy. And I actually think that's easier to teach, say, than also using your gut, because data will only take you so far, and we will never have perfect enough data to make the perfect decisions. There'll always be some assumptions. There'll always be other things where we got, oh, you know, the data's pointing a projected direction, but we will never know like black, white. It's really hard to get massively black or white on all data. A lot of it can be that way. So I still would say that for someone to be completely data literate, they also have to know how to communicate it, which means how to interpret it, how to synthesize it, form a point of view about it, and then rally others to change. So it just depends. So I have, not every firm, not every company needs every single person in their workforce data literate. And we've tried to be really careful where it's like, we had a whole business intelligence goal, right? Everybody get your data right. Oh my gosh, we can't manage our projects. We can't even do resourcing because the data is not correct. Yep. We can't even do this. Like, we're just like, holy cow. So we couldn't just say everyone needs to be data literate. Everyone needs to have a business intelligence goal, because that's how we started. And then it wound up being everyone, just get your time cards in, make sure they're accurate, right? Now, how much data literacy or, you know, training do they need for that? But we had to break it down into this year. We're going to just make sure everybody does this one piece of data accurately, because it was just killing us. Like, it was just killing us because we couldn't resource ahead. So anyway, I do think that it does segment out that those who do need to know the data definitely need to know how to read it, how to interpret what it means, how to synthesize it. I mean, it's just classic, just the classic things everyone needs to know.
Having just gone through an overhaul of our professional services automation platform, Michael got out right as that was happening. But is there that's the sort of thing where there's like a data story that the whole organization needs to hear as to why it's important to fill in your time cards following the guidelines, right? They don't necessarily need to be making the resourcing decision, but there is a story to be told that is, this is why it matters. This is why you can't blow off. This is why you can't wait till the end of the week to enter your stuff, right?
Right. And then it hits home. It's like, that's why you had to work the weekend, because nobody put in the right projects, and we could have known and brought in resources ahead of time, but because job tickets weren't in, you had to work the weekend, whatever. But yeah, there's always a price to pay to the human condition when data is not accurate.
This conversation extremely valuable. And just like your book, Nancy, is so easy to consume some very key insights and information. But we do have to start to wrap up, and it's unfortunate because getting a lot out of this conversation. But one thing we do love to do is go around and do a last call. And that's just sharing something we found recently that we think might be of interest to our listeners, and or something we're up to that, you know, might be useful. So Nancy, you're our guest. Would you like to share a last call?
It can be anything.
Anything.
I just finished, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Talking to Strangers.
Yeah. I have not heard about that.
I don't know how well it will do because it's very challenging. And he goes and has a lot of data to support the fact that two perspectives and the way we perceive them, the one that's right might really be wrong and the one that's wrong might be right. It was a page turner. I really enjoyed it. I just finished it last night on the airplane.
Which he did because he's made like a different kind of audiobook out of that. So like on his Revisionist History podcast, there's an episode where he took the chapter, which I'm now forgetting which one it was on, and kind of plays it. But he kind of said he was trying to go into do a different, because he's doing podcasting now. And he was like, can we blow up the audiobook? My daughter's a huge Gladwell fan.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't listen to the audiobook, but man, it was good. It was startling to me. My heart raced a couple times because it didn't go the direction I thought. It was very interesting. And it's very emotional topics that he was sussing apart. It was good. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would.
Very nice. Mm. What about you, Mo? What's your last call?
Well, we've been talking a little bit about data visualization, which is a topic near and dear, but someone in our data team shared a couple of graphs the other day, which I just found so fun. So they're goodies but oldies. One was on the ABC in Australia, which was Australia's most and least popular birthdays revealed. But then the other one is from Scientific American, which has why are so many babies born around 8 a.m. And it goes through some really amazing data visualizations and the causes and like really breaks it down. And our whole data science team was going a little nerdy over these graphs. So I'll share those.
Nice.
Very nice. Okay, Tim, what about you? What's your last call?
I'm going to go with two because one came up while we were talking and it's refuting myself. Okay. But I don't know. It's a fairly new three-part documentary on Bill Gates on Netflix called Inside Bill's Brain. It's like 3 one-hour things. It's really well done. But the thread that runs through it is how he walks around with this satchel of like 20 to 30 books all the time. So I think when it comes to people presenting to Bill Gates, it comes through very clearly that he has a highly atypical brain and way of taking in information and processing it. But it was fascinating. And then the other one that kind of relates to this topic as well, it's not so much on the presentation, and this was a couple of months ago in the New Yorker, John Seabrook had an article called Can a Machine Learn to Write for the New Yorker? And it gets into kind of OpenAI and GPT-2 and Grammarly, but it's actually when you're reading it, there are parts where it will show you what the OpenAI wrote for like an entire next paragraph in his article. So it kind of starts with just like the smart compose and the smart reply. But I love his writing, and so it comes at it from a whole bunch of different directions and sort of muses about the future of the ability for AI to generate narrative. So it was a good read. So only two, but they were quick. So what do you have, Michael?
Well, I've been thinking about this topic, and so obviously what I've been reading lately is Nancy's new book. So that's sort of one of them. So I'll make that one of my last calls, not to be too self-serving.
Can I interject for 1 minute?
Yes.
I genuinely think that every single analyst, if you work in data, you should read Data Story.
Can I just do my last call?
Someone sent me a message the other day saying they liked my book recommendation. So I wanted to make sure we both recommended it.
She wants to get partial credit.
So if you buy this book, make sure to write into the podcast and say it's because of Mo that you bought it. That will help us all out. No, so that was part of it. But I want to describe a little bit of my reaction as I've read it. The book is beautiful. So if you haven't bought it, it's both a great read as well as I can already tell become a reference. So that's the really good design of a book. But it also has this weird effect on me that I think maybe others will share. And so I'm going to talk about it so we can all commiserate together, which is I read through this and I think, oh, yeah, this all makes so much sense. Yeah, of course that makes. And then I go to write something on a slide and I immediately have this sense of dread of like, I can't make anything that looks that nice. Like, so some of you will go through that and just don't give up. Just keep trying it and the skill will grow, I think. I'm probably, of the four of us right now talking, I'm probably the worst at PowerPoints and slide design and those kinds of things. So
I've seen you present. I think that's an accurate assessment.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. But between you and me, Tim, who gets through to executives better?
It's all your emotional intelligence.
Oh, God. What
there you go, baby. So can't make a slide to save my life, but I connect with the right people. Okay, but the other one, and this is the one, and I kind of want to use the chance that we have to talk to you, Nancy. So, of course, thinking about data and data stories, this thing comes up in my mind. There's this book that was called The Seven Basic Plots.
I love that.
And so this guy, Christopher Booker, basically came out with a book that said, you know, there's only seven stories that really exist. So first off, I just wanted to get your sense of that, Nancy. Like, do you think that's true or is there more than that, less than that?
So some say there's seven, some 26. There's one that says 42. I think I would agree there's a finite set of story plots.
Yeah.
I don't know that anyone has the exact number exactly perfect. I did love the computational story lab. They put in all of these fiction stories and came up with six basic plots, which was pretty powerful. And they're pretty close to Booker. Loved Booker's work, studied that. And then sometimes scripts and movie scripts, and they all have different kind of structures and formats. Right. So it just depends. So I really admire Booker's work too.
Yeah. Anyways, I love the simplicity of that idea. And so like sort of was resonating with me. So I thought I'd mention it. Okay. So that's my last call.
Well, but can I ask even, can it even when, again, not to presenting to an executive, like the challenge would be to, I'm just delivering something to a stakeholder to have read data stories, to think about that and apply that, even if it doesn't feel like it's that important, like, I guarantee it will move the quality and the compellingness of the, I don't know. I feel like that's the little burr that gets in my saddle is. And I've had this discussion with Leah as well. It winds up going down the path of presenting to executives. And I just don't want anybody to walk away thinking this doesn't apply if I'm presenting to, you know, my peers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is true. A lot of times the stakeholders, the ones have to fund it. And that could have, like, that section could have been a little bit more toned down. But we've thought, let's go for the hardest. Like, let's go for the hardest. And everything after that's just cake, right? It should be easier.
Yeah.
I do recommend also listening to Nancy's episode with Leah, because I think they touched on very different points to what we've discussed today. Yep. So if you are listening and you want to delve into the actual specifics of some of the content of the book a bit more, I think that was also a completely amazing discussion.
We keep saying Leah. So Leah Pika, Present Beyond Measure podcast.
Yeah. Present Beyond Measure.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you've been listening and you're thinking, oh, I've got all these ideas, or, you know, what could I do about this situation? We'd love to hear from you. The best way to reach us is on the Measure Slack group or on Twitter or on our LinkedIn group page. So please reach out if you have more questions. I don't know, Nancy, if you get on the social media. I think you're kind of a big deal. So like maybe a lot of people reaching out to you directly.
She is all over the social media.
Are you? Okay. Well, there you go.
And I believe, it's true story, you don't ever decline a LinkedIn request. You're worse than I am.
I take all my LinkedIn requests. Yeah. That's pretty active out there, that little community, huge community. Yeah.
Oh, well, wow. I just learned I could connect with Nancy Duarte and LinkedIn today. So awesome. Anyway, we'd love to hear from you. Sounds like Nancy is a person who'd love to hear from you too. So please reach out. And obviously, if you are a senior leader of a massive company, now you know who to work with on communicating stories and data effectively. All right. I know I speak for both of my co-hosts, both Tim and Mo. And first, thanking you, Nancy, for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun, you guys.
And of course, we always do this show with the support of our producer, Josh Crowhurst. So thank you, Josh. And remember, no matter how good or bad your visuals, or whether your executive wants to see it in just tables or pie charts, remember, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Twitter or in the Measure Slack. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io or on Twitter at analyticshour.